The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to a special edition of Progressive Commentary Hour. This is an original in-depth investigative report. The title, In the Name of Freedom, Peace, and Democracy. I will be sharing with you the research of many scholars. It's taken quite a long time to read these different essays, books, and articles, more than 100 in total. I'll be drawing from the BBC. I'll be drawing also from The Guardian and Human Rights Council, Amnesty International, Haaretz, and Human Rights Watch. Also from many of the leading scholars who have written on imperial overreach. This program is meant to give us an understanding of what happens when we do go into a country. You'll hear verbatim comments from William Blum and the essay, The U.S. versus Iraq, A Study in Hypocrisy, plus other work that this great scholar has done. As best as I can, I will keep to their exact messages from The Nation magazine, from Mark Curtis, from the Christian Science Monitor and Laura Flanders, from Reuters and dozens of others. So I am pulling all this together in order to have what I consider a sobering perspective on what we do in the name of freedom, peace, and democracy. At least that's the message sold to the American public by the mainstream media. I remember a piece that was on Bill O'Reilly leading up to the war in Iraq, where he was emphatic and determined in his statement that once the war starts, there can no more be a debate on the subject, should we be there? You must either be with America on our side, or we must consider you no better than an enemy combatant of the United States. And I thought, I hope that there are people in the audience who understand that's exactly what we shouldn't be doing. We should open ourselves up to honest debate. We did not. With rare exception, almost all the American media lined up behind the invasion of Iraq. Go back now and take a look, as we will in this program, and show you the consequences. Wherever possible, I will look at the underlying authentic reasons that we are in these countries. And you will begin to see a constant serial pattern of exploitation, manipulation, for power, for the resources, and control over the future of that country. I'm going to lead in our discussion from Tom Dispatch, from Nick Terse, an article that he wrote on uncovering the military's secret military. I'll quote just some of this. Somewhere on this planet, an American commando is carrying out a mission. Now, say that 70 times and you're done for the day. Without the knowledge of the American public, a secret force within the U.S. military is undertaking operations in a majority of the world's countries. This new Pentagon power elite is waging a global war whose size and scope has never been revealed until now. After a U.S. Navy SEAL put a bullet in Osama bin Laden's chest and another in his head, one of the most secretive black op units in the American military suddenly found its mission in the public spotlight. It was atypical. While it's well known that U.S. Special Operations Forces are deployed in the war zones of Afghanistan and Iraq, it's increasingly apparent that such units operate in murky conflict zones like Yemen and Somalia. The full extent of their worldwide war has remained deeply in the shadows. Last year, Karen DeYoung and Greg Jaffe of the Washington Post reported that U.S. Special Operations Forces were deployed in 75 countries, up from 60 at the end of the Bush presidency. By the end of this year, U.S. Special Operations Command spokesman Colonel Tim Nye told me that number will likely reach 120 countries. Now, that's 60% of the world's nations, and far larger than previously acknowledged. Born of a failed 1980 raid to rescue American hostages in Iran, in which 8 U.S. service members died, U.S. Special Operations Command, or SOCOM, was established in 1987. Having spent the post-Vietnam years distrusted and starved for money by the regular military, Special Operations Forces suddenly had a single home, a stable budget, and a 4-star commander as their advocate. Since then, SOCOM has grown into a combined force of startling proportions, made up of units from all the service branches, including the Army's Green Berets, the Rangers, the Navy SEALs, Air Force Air Commandos, and Marine Corps Special Operations teams, in addition to specialized helicopter crews, boat teams, civil air affairs personnel, pararescue men, and even battlefield air traffic controllers and special operations weathermen. SOCOM carries out the U.S.'s most specialized and secret missions: assassinations, counter-terrorist raids, long-range reconnaissance, intelligence analysis, foreign troop training, and weapons of mass destruction, counter-proliferation operations. And then it goes on to talk about how many people were there. 60,000. Its budget, almost $10 billion. And virtually non-accountable to anyone except the President of the United States. This may be news to many of the people reading that article for the first time. It is not new to those of us who have studied American intervention. During our program, I'm going to take you to various countries and give you just highlights, brief highlights, of our intervention in some countries and what we should know about it. And I'm going to begin with Haiti, because recently on this program, I had a reporter who has lived in Haiti, speaks the language, Creole, and discussed the problems that she found there, and how we are the problem, and what we do to make the problems there even worse. Haiti's history is full of cases that demonstrate how this country and its people have been abused at the hands of international powers. After its independence from the French crown in 1804, Haiti was obligated by France and other Western countries to pay a colossal 150 million francs in debt for so-called reparations. Failure to comply with these conditions meant the imposition of an embargo on Haiti. Even though this number was lowered to 90 million francs in 1834, it remained a widely unreasonable external debt that would severely impair the country's potential for economic growth for over a century. By 1900, the Haitian government was spending 80% of its entire budget, attempting to make good on its repayment to France, yet still had to take additional loans at very high interest rates from countries like the United States. And while the government managed to repay its debt in 1947, the funneling of so many resources into debt repayment had taken its toll, and the country was in a state of political and economic turmoil. In comes the Duvaliers. Francois Papa Doc Duvalier and his son Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier were the notorious dictators of Haiti, serving respective terms from 1957 to 1971 and 71 to 86. During their time in power, they ruled in brutal military fashion that led to the disappearance of 60,000 Haitians and the rape and torture of hundreds of thousands more. At the beginning of his presidency, Francois maintained close ties with the United States, and the United States gave ample military support from the Marine Corps. This relationship extended to American corporations as well, as Papa Doc arranged for 20,000 Haitian laborers to be sent to the neighboring country of the Dominican Republic to work on American-owned plantations. at impossibly low wages. In some cases, there would be 10 to 15 men in one room sleeping on a bare wooden floor, no mattress, no bedding. Their food was a meager bowl of rice per day. And yet, with the full knowledge of our State Department and our CIA and the military, these people, meaning individuals from Haiti who were working on the farms in the Dominican Republic, mainly sugar plantations, were not allowed to leave because they were charged compounding interest on rent. If they ate food, they were charged for the food, but they would be charged 10 times more for a bowl of rice than if the person had purchased the rice, but they were not allowed to purchase. And then they were charged rent, sometimes at $2 a day when they only made $1 a day. Hence, they could never leave here until they simply died from exhaustion. Again, the President of the United States, the President's Cabinet, all the leading legislative oversight groups were fully aware of this exploitation and did nothing but supported it. While relations between Haiti and the United States cooled toward the end of the first Papadoc regime, the United States exhibited a tacit approval and glaring lack of action on the gross human rights abuses that persisted until the overthrow of Baby Doc in 1986. The fact that the United States contributed $500 million in international aid packages earmarked for Haiti from 1972 to 81 speaks to such approval. However, those aid packages never went to aid the average Haitian. In fact, a shocking example of the culture of depravity that defined Jean-Claude's government can be seen in the case of his Minister of Interior, Luckner Cambroni, who was found to be profiting off the sale of blood from thousands of Haitian citizens to private medical firms in the United States. Despite the widespread impoverishment conditions that define Haiti during their rule, it is estimated that 80% of all international aid given to Haiti was embezzled and found its way into private bank accounts and then back into American bank accounts, while around 45% of Haiti's total current debt can be attributed to the shady dealings of the Duvaliers. These institutions have failed to forgive the struggling nation of their debt. Put into perspective, some have speculated that after the ouster of Jean-Claude Duvalier in 1986, he left the country with around $900 million. Where did he put this money? He put it in banks in France and in Switzerland. Now, would you might assume that someone in the French government or in the Swiss government would ask, how could you possibly have this amount of money? Well, they have been looking the other way at every dictatorship and every ruling individual stashing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, into their bank accounts. And no, they chose not to investigate him, and they chose not to appropriate the money and give it back to the government. Over the last 30 years, neoliberal policies implemented by the U.S. and organizations such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank have brought about profoundly negative results for the majority of Haitians. Now, let me give you an example of Haiti's misfortune dealing with world financial institutions on the country's agricultural system. It would take Haiti decades to regain stability, especially under the oppressive rule of the Duvaliers. However, in 1980, Haitian farmers were able to produce enough food to feed most of the population, a number that has plunged to 43% since the introduction of structural adjustment programs by the IGOs. Now, an example of the implementation of such neoliberal mandates occurred in 1982, when, in an effort to curb the spread of swine fever in Haiti, livestock, USAID, ordered the killing of every single pig in the country. Now, that did not mean these pigs were all infected, but meant a relatively small few in one area were infected. The decision that cost farmers hundreds of millions of dollars and deprived an untold number of people of what for them was an important source of food during a time of significant population growth. President Ronald Reagan helped bring about the Caribbean Basin Initiative in 1983, which was purportedly enacted to open nations like Haiti to positive free trade opportunities. But in actuality, it drove down the price of almost all crops that they had grown there and had been, even though they were poor, they were sustainable, they had enough to eat. And as a result, this devastated what were historically local self-sufficient food markets. This began a strong trend toward neoliberal reform in Haiti, a large part of which was characterized by the dumping of U.S.-grown crops in Haiti. USAID, along with the International Monetary Fund, supported programs that were supposedly aimed at creating exportation hubs of manufacturing in urban areas. And during the 1980s, Haitian cities saw large influxes of migrants who could no longer afford to cultivate their own food in rural locales. This demographic shift produced a flood of laborers willing to take low-paying jobs in factories creating products, especially textiles, for American companies. This strategy was entirely unsuccessful in alleviating poverty and hunger and only worked to exacerbate existing conditions and set the stage for multinational corporations like Nike, Reebok, and Disney to take advantage of sweatshop labor in Haiti. Much of the controversy surrounding the economic reforms foisted upon Haiti by the world financial institutions in the United States deals with rice, just a basic item in Haitian cooking. The international monetary policies implemented in 1985 forced Haiti to lower tariff rates on rice from 35%, which protected the local farmer in Haiti, to 3%. That was a measure that seriously impaired Haitian farmers' ability to sell their crops and resulted in a large increase in rice imports from other countries, chiefly the United States. Currently, U.S.-based corporations sell over half of all the rice consumed in Haiti, and only 18% of the rice consumed in the country is grown there. American companies like Agrigiant Early Industries has been the largest rice importer to Haiti and one of its subsidiaries. Chemiconics was among the first businesses to secure a contract in the aftermath of the January 2010 earthquake. That contract was given by USAID and is valued at $50 million. Former President Bill Clinton's heavy involvement in reconstruction in Haiti after the destructive January 2010 earthquake comes with a great sense of irony, given Clinton and the U.S. history of intervention in the country that produced devastating consequences for the Haitian people. Clinton personally, with his wife, played a significant role in gutting traditional agricultural practices in Haiti through pushing for lower tariffs on crops and supporting the interest of American corporations. In 1990, Haitians democratically elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide to the office of president. His term was to be short-lived as a coup overthrew him in early 1991. A military junta would come to power for a few years until Clinton interceded on behalf of Aristide by sending 20,000 American troops to Haiti to defeat the poorly organized military and restore the former president. This so-called favor came with a set of conditions Aristide was obligated by the U.S. government to accept that came to be known as the Plan of Death. Among the stipulations, Aristide's administration was required to implement if he was to go back into power. They must do cutbacks, radical cutbacks in social spending, and acquiesce to American agribusiness selling their products to Haiti at very low cost. In 2010, Clinton went on the record apologizing for his promotion of these programs, saying, quote, "It may have been good for some of my farmers in Arkansas, but it has not worked." You think? Some reform earned Haiti top marks from the International Monetary Fund Index of Trade Restrictiveness. But despite adhering to such neoliberal guidelines, over half of Haiti's populace has continued to face extreme poverty and starvation and the vast majority of the population lives on less than $2 a day. A report recently indicated that over the previous 40 years, the real gross domestic product for Haiti declined by 30%. In a telling set of figures, Haiti was scheduled to pay out $57 million in debt, but only collected $39 million in foreign aid. In the post-earthquake era, Haiti awaits a new round of loans doled out by the International Monetary Fund, full of neoliberal conditions such as bans on increased wages for government employees, the inability to raise the cost of electricity, mandates that would undermine the chances of Haiti asserting its sovereignty. These measures faced great opposition among activists and human rights organizations who were successful in stopping most of these initiatives from moving forward. In July of 2010, the International Monetary Fund made a decision to forgive Haiti's $268 million debt and at the same time offer a new $60 million loan aimed at strengthening Haiti's central bank. The International Monetary Fund officials also claimed that they expect for Haiti's economy to grow by 9% over the next year. That's just one example. I will share some other examples now. Let's take a look at Panama and the Panama Canal. The founding of the nation of Panama was a direct consequence of U.S. intervention in South America. When President Theodore Roosevelt looked to create a canal in the Colombian territory at the turn of the 20th century, the canal has long seen as a strategic boon to American European powers, and the U.S. made Colombia an offer to create and maintain a canal connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, which was completely rejected by Colombian officials and the Colombian population. So in the fall of 1903, the record clearly shows that Felipe Varela and William Cromwell of Panama Railroad, a subsidiary to the new Panama Canal Company, had corresponded with Roosevelt about the United States' potential involvement in an uprising they were planning, even though Roosevelt denied any connection or foreknowledge. A revolution in Panama began on November 3rd of 1903, a day after U.S. warships arrived on both sides of the isthmus. With the help of the United States forces and the manipulation and bribery on the part of the Cromwell Group, the revolution succeeded in just a matter of days. President Roosevelt claimed that U.S. American naval forces were there to assist the Panamanian revolutionaries and justified this under a treaty dating back to 1846 that allowed the U.S. to stop the Colombian military from suppressing internal insurrection, and the president moved quickly to recognize Panama as an independent nation. Construction of the canal began immediately and was completed in 1914. This time period was characterized by heavy influence of the United States in the political affairs of Panama through quelling internal uprisings and maintaining political stability. Here's what President Roosevelt said in 1911. "I took the canal zone, and I let the Congress debate. And while the debate goes on, the canal does also." Wasn't even hiding much there. Now, in 1968, Panama experienced a coup that resulted in populist leader Omar Torrijos taking control of what was a military dictatorship. He died in a plane crash in 1981, which almost all of the people investigating claim was a murder. Soon after his death, CIA asset and known drug trafficker Manuel Noriega gained control as the leader of Panama with the full support of the United States. Now, despite his record of involvement with the drug trade and human rights violations during his time working under the former president as military commander, Noriega had been on the payroll of the CIA since 1972. In the late 1980s, Noriega fell out of favor with U.S. backers. He rigged national elections that consolidated his dictatorial power even further and adopted an increasingly aggressive stance against the United States. In addition, his support for the U.S. Supported Nicaraguan Contra forces waned. All of a sudden, President George Bush expressed his disapproval of Noriega's undemocratic policies and his involvement in the drug trade. The American press followed suit, painting Noriega as a drug trafficking tyrant. Soon thereafter, Bush went ahead and to remove the Panamanian leader and launched Operation Just Cause in December of 1989. The invasion succeeded in toppling the Noriega regime and killed untold thousands of innocent civilians. That's according to Physicians for Human Rights, estimate that 85% of the deaths were civilian. The United States military destroyed the homes and businesses of 15,000 people. In the aftermath of the invasion, President Bush announced a $1 billion package for Panama, almost half of which was earmarked for American corporations investing in the country. At his trial, Noriega made the claim that the CIA had paid him over $10 million as he worked to steal the elections and protect American interests in the region for almost 20 years, including when then-President Bush was also formerly head of the CIA. The American media chose not to pay attention. Let's take a look at one of the darker errors in American involvement in other countries, and that is Nicaragua. Nicaragua has experienced a long history of intervention by the United States and its military. Beginning in the 1840s, many within the United States government began to see Nicaragua's potential value given the country's natural resources and strategic position between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. In 1849, American magnate Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt planned the construction of a canal across the country, but faced opposition by British interests inside the country. The competition between the U.S. and Great Britain for Nicaragua's resources came to a halt in 1855 when American filibuster William Walker staged an all-out invasion of the country. Walker's effectively declared himself the leader of the country, and his first mandate was to sanction slavery. Over the course of 2 years, he found himself facing mounting opposition from conservatives within the country and Vanderbilt with his business aspirations, and Costa Rica, which had declared war on Walker's regime. In 1857, he was eventually expelled from the country. In 1870, the Nicaraguan government demanded reparations from the United States government for the economic and social turmoil that resulted from Walker's rule. The United States government gave them nothing. Then you have a place many of you have probably never heard of, Zelaya. United States investment in fruit and coffee industries in Nicaragua proliferated during the second half of the 19th century, while at the same time, the president of the country, Zelaya, adopted an increasingly anti-United States rhetoric and sought to work with England to construct a railroad system. According to the Taft administration, this stood in the violation of the Monroe Doctrine, which called for non-intervention by Europe in the Americas. 400 Marines were dispatched to the Central American nation, where they worked to oust the president of office in 1909. From 1910 through 1933, the United States maintained a very strong military presence in the country, ensuring that the Nicaraguan government remained sympathetic to U.S. interest in crops such as banana and coffee, and to prevent other foreign powers from constructing a canal similar to the United States project in Panama. The Somoza dynasty was ruthless. In 1936, military leader named Somoza became Nicaragua's leader and began what would amount to a dynasty defined by military dictatorships. The American schooled Somoza was formally in charge of the Nicaraguan National Guard and ran the country in the style of a military junta. He received funding from the United States and worked to promote American investments in the country while gaining control over many industries as a private businessman. His estimated worth from his assets totaled over $100 million. The son of him, Louis Somoza, came to power in 1957 and much like his father, curried favor with the United States and received assistance for his anti-communist stance and his opposition to the increasingly popular leftist Sandinista National Liberation Front. They were vehemently anti-union. They were anti-demonstration. They did not believe in freedom of the press. And after his death in 1967, he was succeeded by a brother, Anastasio, and in a fraudulent election. And over the next 10 years, his policy strengthened the brutal military regime established by his family, and that would set the stage for the coming conflict with the Sandinista forces in the 1980s. Let's shift over now for a moment to the Contra. A clear case of American interventionism can be seen in the case of the Iran-Contra affair. In the early 1980s, it was discovered that the CIA had been funding a rebel group in Nicaragua known as the Contras. Armed with weapons from the United States, the Contras waged a campaign against the populist leftist Sandinista party that overthrown the military dictatorships of the Somoza family. Now, despite the passage of the Boland Amendment, which expressly prohibited monetary support for the Contras to overthrow the Sandinistas, U.S. officials such as Oliver North, the same Oliver North you see on Fox television as a contributor, devised a scheme to use money obtained from weapons sales with Iran. The monetary support for the Contras went to a group that engaged in rape and torture to further their political goals. They also carried out assassinations on teachers and healthcare workers. The CIA even created a manual that encouraged assassination of any politicians that disagreed with American policy. The Sandinista leaders took the U.S. government to the World Court seeking reparations for the role America played in their civil war. The Sandinistas won the court decision and the United States was ordered to pay out $17 billion. Washington never paid out the $17 billion. They never paid anything. And when the Sandinista leadership fell out of power in 1990, the Nicaraguan government dropped their claim on the reparations payment. In July of 2011, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega revived the debate on the issue when he proposed a referendum on whether or not there was an effort to obtain what was owed the country. And by the way, at that time it was shown that our U.S. Attorney General, the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, his entire cabinet, all were aware that we were trading weapons that we were making in the United States for cocaine. So we would get cocaine, and that would go through different cities, and we would give them weapons. We funded them. Now we have Guatemala and the ousting of Arbenz. In 1954, the Guatemalan president was ousted from office by the United States operatives after instituting a number of reforms in his country that threatened American business interest. Arbenz was democratically elected to office in 1951 and easily won the presidency. His cabinet contained several communists, and during his term, he adopted a policy that was too communistic in nature for many of in the United States government. As president, he allowed for the formation of unions and the free participation in government by diverse ideological groups. He also began land reforms, hoping to benefit the poor, allowing them to take advantage of largely unused farmland and to create food cooperatives. In the 1950s, the agri-giant United Fruit Company was one of the largest landholders in the country. For years, the corporation distorted the true value of their landholdings to avoid paying higher taxes to the Guatemalan government. This ended up backfiring on them when the president ordered the land to be sold back to the country at the same value that was stated by the United Fruit Company. And as a result, they suddenly said, no, our land is worth much more. Too late, you've been paying us low taxes by understating it. And then the United Fruit Company hired Edward Bernays, who arranged for journalists from agencies like Time Magazine and the San Francisco Chronicle and the New York Times to enjoy a luxury trip to Guatemala. After that, numerous articles appeared in the American press vilifying the president of Guatemala. Now, in the midst of rising tensions between the Guatemalan government and United Fruit Company, and fear generated over the president's ostensible socialist agenda, President Eisenhower authorized the CIA to execute a coup to take him from power. The CIA conducted an operation leading exiled Guatemalans back into the country with the goal of inciting revolt. When the operation failed, Eisenhower ordered an airborne attack of Guatemalan military bases. This forced the president into exile and marked the beginning of decades of heavy U.S. military intervention in the country. The United States sent the elite Green Berets into Guatemala to train and build a formidable army to enforce the brutal dictates of rulers like Romero Lucas Garcia and the indigenous and underprivileged Mayan populations were a target for the army. In fact, there was a UN report that said that there were massacred 448 people in just one village, just all unarmed villagers. Most of the inhabitants were just older individuals, and regular cases of torture, rape, kidnapping, and assassinations were carried out at the hands of the military. And during the course of such civil unrest, which went on for over 35 years, it is estimated that over 150,000 people, just native population, were murdered, or what they call disappeared, which means they were murdered. They were never seen alive again. The United States was responsible for Guatemala's descent into civil war that resulted in a staggering death toll. All the while, companies like United Fruit, later to be called Chiquita Brands International, continued to capitalize on Guatemala's fertile land. And they would meet regularly, meaning the CIA, its field operatives, its military intelligence, with the top landowners and the corporate interest, and make up lists. Who are unionists? They were to be killed. Who are people who are interested in free speech? Disappear them. That was the order of the day. And that all benefited the landowners who were making profits or international corporations. Then we have Chile and overthrowing Allende. Chile stands as another example of United States interventionism in the affairs of Latin American nations. A democratically elected Salvador Allende rose to the presidency of Chile in 1970. He was a leftist favoring Marxist ideologies and moved quickly to revamp the Chilean economic model through measures like nationalizing the country's copper industry. Even before he was elected, documents reveal he was a target of CIA operations to undermine his power and prevent him from rising to power. Even though the United States denied any involvement in a violent military coup that overthrew him in 1973, documentation that has been made available under Freedom of Information shows that the CIA and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger were advocating strongly for his removal and supporting would-be insurgents and instigators. The coup consisted of a raid by the Chilean Air Force on the presidential palace, where he was found dead in the aftermath. Evidently, having killed himself rather than turning himself over to the military commander, Augusto Pinochet, who would become Chile's next president. The question is, did he actually commit suicide? As we speak, there's an effort to exhume his body and to do proper forensic examination. Many individuals I've spoken with over the years believe that he was assassinated. Documents declassified by the CIA show how the U.S. was quick to offer monetary aid to the Pinochet regime despite knowledge of his heavy-handed military tactics. In 1975, individuals working in the State Department petitioned to stop U.S. aid from flowing to the Chilean government, citing Pinochet's authoritarian government. Their requests were ignored by officials at the Pentagon and the U.S. Treasury Department, who continued economic support for his brutal and murderous government. In one case, the CIA made a payment of $35,000 to a group who plotted and killed Chilean General René Schneider, a court of Allende. And during the course of Pinochet's rule that extended from 73 to 90, he employed torture and violence against Chileans while suppressing political expression and dissent. Pinochet's regime was responsible for the direct murder of over 3,000 individuals and the torture of over 30. Now, here is what one individual said, and we should pay attention to this person. He was one of the most decorated soldiers in American history and one of the most respected. U.S. General Smedley Butler, this is what he said in 1933. Quote, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active service in the military, and during that period of time, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1902 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. End quote. Rare that you have someone who was major force in helping to promote American interest, always in the name of freedom, democracy, and peace. But now we're seeing the real nature of this. I'm going to take a step forward now and give a different perspective on the war in Libya. If you listen to my radio program, then you will remember I said you will not have any quick victory in Libya because it is not a one-man country. It is a country with 2,000 tribes. Many of these tribes have strong ideological and religious differences. And the moment you intervene, then you disrupt this delicate balance that has kept them from fighting each other. That's exactly what has happened. And as a result, 6 months into this conflict, now we're seeing that those who had previously not supported Gaddafi directly are now willing to because members of their tribes have been killed by other tribesmen. Now we are seeing a beginning of a major civil conflict as we have never seen before in Libya. In March of 2011, the United States military began operations in Libya as part of a UN or NATO mission. The United States is the primary financial backer of NATO, contributing 75% of the budget, and American taxpayers are paying more than $3 million a day to support this campaign. The NATO airstrikes are ostensibly being waged to take out leader Muammar Gaddafi, who, according to reports propagated by Washington and Western news media, was carrying out a genocide on his own people, chiefly in the city of Benghazi. Months later, these reports were shown to be inaccurate by groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Large demonstrations in the Libyan capital of Tripoli show widespread support for Gaddafi. Gaddafi was openly calling for resolution through diplomatic channels to resolve the situation through third parties like the African Union. But once started, no stopping. A recent commentary by Stephen Ledman on Progressive Radio Network sheds light on the New York Times' role in subserviently beating the war drum for the Obama administration in the lead-up to NATO's invasion of Libya, much as it did in Judith Miller's beating the drums by saying there was weapons of mass destruction and she had the inside scoop with a special person from Iraq, and of course that all turned out to be nothing but lies. Since the start of the offensive, the New York Times and its journalists have strongly endorsed the United States' involvement. In February 2011, columnist Erwin Kotler and Gerard Gessner wrote a piece calling for U.S. officials to take swift and decisive military action against Gaddafi. They argued that the United Nations, Security Council's financial sanctions and travel bans against Gaddafi were insufficient and urged leaders to move forward with military intervention in Libya to prevent mass atrocities from taking place. The article's authors wrote that, in legal terms, Gaddafi is no longer the legitimate Libyan head of state. Despite the patently false claim that mass atrocities were being carried out, they have the audacity to suggest that NATO establishing a no-fly zone would preclude any bombing of civilians. In August of 2011, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon voiced his concern over the high civilian casualties rate in Libya. His statements were echoed by many, including Hugh Robert, a director for the International Crisis Group, who expressed his skepticism over the NATO bombing, saying, "They are killing civilians rather than preventing civilian deaths." The decisions concerning military actions taking place in Libya are largely conducted by the U.S. A French official revealed that 80% of the targets for French pilots came from U.S. officials. The U.S. has also supplied much of the equipment. The same French general revealed that 33 of 41 tanker aircraft deployed from America, as are all of the drones and laser guidance kits for bombs. According to the Center for Research on Globalization, quote, "The first target of the war was the mint which prints and issues Libyan dinars and the country's food storage facilities. Several humanitarian organizations were targeted, including schools, a children's center, hospitals, the office of the Down Syndrome Society, the Handicapped Women's Foundation, the National Diabetic Research Center, the Crippled Children's Foundation. Among the hospitals and medical facilities which have been bombed is a complex used for medical oxygen production," end quote. NATO is openly admitted to accidentally targeting vehicles carrying civilians and subsequently killing children and infants. In another case, the building which housed Libyan state television was destroyed by NATO warplanes, resulting in the deaths of several journalists. Given the political climate in Libya, it is unlikely that the removal of Gaddafi would do anything but destabilize the country even further, as there are several factors and factions that have not been considered, and they are all vying for power in the country. Some have suggested that the United States' engagement with Libya may be connected to Gaddafi's calls to create a new gold-backed currency. Libya has an entirely state-owned central bank, which, according to the official estimates, possesses 144 tons of gold. Over the past several years, Gaddafi has advocated publicly for the creation of a new reserve currency, the gold dinar, to be used in Muslim and African nations. Clearly, the U.S. and European nations dealing in dollars, in euros, would be threatened economically by a currency overhaul carried out by Libya and other countries. If such a currency came into existence, many oil-producing nations could potentially dictate the price of their reserves and demand gold from trade partners. Some liken this situation to what happened in 2000 when Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein changed the currency of his country's oil and was traded in replacing dollars with euros. Mexico's central bank made headlines in May of 2011 to vastly increase their gold reserves from less than 7 tons to over 100 tons in an apparent effort to move away from the shaky status of the U.S. dollar. The United States military invaded Iraq in 2003 under the orders of George Bush, who claimed that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein was harboring weapons of mass destruction that could be used to attack the U.S. Much of the intelligence that pointed to the existence of weapons of mass destruction was taken from an informant known as Curveball, who was later identified as Ahmed al-Janabi, an Iraqi national who defected to Germany. In an apparent attempt to improve his status as a defector, he told the German authorities that Hussein was producing chemical and biological weapons that could be used to murder large numbers of people, even though his claims were considered completely false by German intelligence agents who did a lie detector test on him. They passed along the information to the CIA. European CIA head Tyler Drumheller told CIA chief George Tenet that the claims were false. But Tenet went ahead and presented curveball's testimony to George Bush and his cabinet, clearly disposed to project military force in the region. Bush and those in his administration began to use the untrue claims as a rationale for war and pressured those in the American intelligence community to fabricate more evidence to bolster their case. The Bush administration ignored very credible sources that indicated Iraq had no possibility for weapons of mass destruction, including the CIA operatives who met in secret with Iraqi scientists, gathered intelligence that suggests that such weapon programs did not exist. In September 2002, a report by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency stated unequivocally that their supply was non-existent in Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. There was no evidence to prove that Iraq was producing or stockpiling any chemical weapons. In February 2003, UN's weapons inspector Hans Blix informed the UN Security Council that no weapons of mass destruction had been uncovered in the country and expressed his desire to continue with his inspections. In February 2003, a CIA missive plainly stated there was, quote, no direct evidence of Iraq's capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction. Now, another factor that helped galvanize the American public to support the invasion was the reporting by journalist Judith Miller, now also on Fox News, with the New York Times. In numerous articles published by the New York Times starting in late 2001, Miller hyped the threat of Saddam's capacity for employing destructive weaponry. Much of her reporting was based on information given to her by individuals associated with the Iraqi National Congress, an extraordinarily corrupt group, completely discredited, nothing more than a bunch of gangsters. But this group dealt with Iraqi refugees and advocated for regime change in Iraq. At the head of this group of Iraqi National Congress was a known criminal. He had been found guilty in absentia of embezzling over $100 million from a Jordanian bank. He was Ahmad Chalabi, an Iraqi exile and staunch opponent of Saddam Hussein, and one of the most gross opportunists you've ever met. And he evidently had designs on a leadership position after Saddam was toppled. And many of the claims coming from Chalabi and those in the Iraq National Congress turned out to be exaggerated or simply lies. Among their assertions was that Iraq possessed mobile facilities that were producing biological weapons. Not true. These alleged laboratories turned out to be storage units for materials used to make weather balloons. But that didn't matter for those who wanted to be convinced. Chalabi had also been criticized for his alleged role in an embezzlement scheme in Jordan. In 1992, Chalabi was sentenced in absentia to 22 years hard labor by a Jordanian military tribunal who found him guilty on 31 charges, including theft, misuse of depository funds, and embezzlement. This came after the 1989 crash of the bank owned by Chalabi, located in Petra, Jordan. Shortly after the collapse, Chalabi fled the country for the United Kingdom. At the time, Chalabi's bank was the third largest bank in the country, and the Jordanian government had to pay out $200 million to investors in order to avoid a national financial disaster. Jordanian officials produced ample documentation linking Chalabi and his bank to suspicious trading and banking activities. After his escape with all of his money from Jordan, Chalabi was found living in a very exclusive neighborhood of London. He became close friends with Dick Cheney and was a favorite of the neocons in Congress. Judith Miller was also fed faulty information by Bush administration official Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby. Stalwart neoconservatives who gladly supplied Miller with altered intelligence that strengthened the case for war, but was almost all untrue. On national television, Vice President Dick Cheney parroted Miller's supposedly reliable information that Iraq had important aluminum tubes to build nuclear stories, and he knew in advance that that information was patently false. Cheney out and out lied to the American public. In February 2003, Secretary of State Colin Powell presented the case for invading Iraq before the United Nations, warning that Saddam Hussein's weapons stockpile could wreak untold destruction. In his address, Powell alluded to the alleged biological weapons facilities and urged world leaders to support a preemptive strike. Scooter Libby came under fire in 2003 when it was discovered that he had a role in leaking the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame to the press. Plame, the wife of U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, was thought to be targeted by individuals in the Bush administration because of critical public statements made by Wilson about President Bush's declaration during the 2003 State of the Union address that Saddam Hussein had sought a deal to secure yellowcake uranium from Niger. Just a year before, Wilson's official reports to the CIA suggested this was an unfounded claim. Wilson expressed his incredulity over Bush's statements, and shortly thereafter, in July 2003, Valerie Plame's identity was revealed by columnist Robert Novak. FBI investigations led to indictments against Cheney's chief of staff, who was eventually found guilty and received jail time for counts of obstruction of justice and perjury. And while Libby was found guilty in the court case, evidence pointing to Dick Cheney providing Libby's with Plame's name apparently intent on ruining her career. Why? Why create a war when none need exist? It's simple. Follow the money trail. Profiteering from war in Iraq and profiteering from intervention in every country in the world is the big business. Dick Cheney's career exemplifies the revolving door that exists between the military-industrial complex and politics. Serving as Secretary of Defense under George Bush, Cheney's strong ties to defense contractors would become evident. And this is how he was described by Turnspeed. Quote, commissioned a study for the U.S. Department of Defense by Brown & Root Services, now Kellogg Brown & Root, a wholly owned subsidiary of Halliburton. The study recommended that private firms like Halliburton should take over logistical support programs for U.S. military operations around the world, unquote. Now, once his term in office ended, Cheney became the chief executive officer of Halliburton, where he earned over $44 million in 5 years. Thanks to Cheney's push for reliance on private contractors, Halliburton thrived during this period. The company stood to gain even more with the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Moving back into politics, Cheney served as vice president in an administration that granted enormous contracts to Halliburton. From 2003, when the war in Iraq began, to 2006, just 3 years, the company was given $17 billion to do business in Iraq. Halliburton has played a large role in the exploitation of the Middle East oil reserves, and in one instance, Halliburton received a no-bid contract valued at $7 billion, and much of it going to tap Iraq oil fields, even though he denied any financial interest in connection with Halliburton once he left the company. It was proven that Cheney was still receiving $150,000 a year from his former employee as late as 2003. DynCorp, a private equity fund owned by Veritas Capital Fund, has profited enormously from the Iraq and Afghan wars. Since the start of the occupation, DynCorp, D-Y-N, Corp, has made billions and billions of dollars annually, providing the U.S. military with logistical support and aerospace technologies. In 2009, DynCorp closed a five-year, $6 billion deal with the U.S. government to support troops serving in southern Afghanistan. In addition, they're involved in a $4.7 billion deal sending 9,100 translators to military units in Iraq over the course of several years. And a clear example of the revolving door that exists between the U.S. military and private contractors like Dime Court, Anthony Zinni, the former commander-in-chief of U.S. Central Command, from 1997-2000, accepted a position as executive vice president of Dime Corp in 2007. Peter Shoemaker, who served as the U.S. Army Chief of Staff from 2000-2007, went a similar route. In 2007, Shoemaker secured a position on the board of directors of Dime Corp. Dime Corp employees supporting U.S. military efforts is not unusual. But there is a highly disturbing incident that came to light in 1999. It was discovered that some of the Dime Corp employees supporting U.S. military efforts in Bosnia were engaging in horrific sexual abuse and slave trafficking of minors from Eastern Europe. Revelations from WikiLeaks in 2009 linked Dime Corp employees in Afghanistan with the perverse practice of dancing boys, when underage boys dressed in drag are brought to men-only parties to dance and entertain. A report released in 2010 by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction illustrated the unsettling lack of oversight by the U.S. over private weapons contractors. In the report, the U.S. State Department was shown to have not accounted for over $1 billion given over to Dime Corp mercenaries over the course of that small, short period of time. Also, I might mention that $7 billion in actual cash disappeared in Iraq and was never seen again. That's $7 billion. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to an original, in-depth investigative report in the name of Freedom, Peace, and Democracy. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm encouraging you to share this information with whoever you believe would find this empowering and important. We're now seeing the rewriting of virtually all foreign policy in American history by neocons and people promoting a neoliberal globalization philosophy throughout the world. Free market, they call it. Clearly, there's nothing free in the market. I'm merely trying to show you what hundreds of scholars, people whose work you may not have heard of, including Mr. Blum and others, have written about, but few people read that work. So it's their scholarship and their work and their investigations that I'm sharing. I want to thank Jeremy Stillman, who took a great deal of time and effort in helping with this information. Let us continue on our exploration. Let's examine Saudi Arabia, and I also think it's worth looking at the fact that of the 22 Arab League nations, where in the past year we have seen nearly 100 million people in the Arab world engaged in uprisings, not for religious reasons in most cases. In most cases, it was for something as basic as food and work and better standard of living and housing and freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, freedom for women to work, and also to have some parity with men in the workplace that had been completely absent for decades in the Middle East, in most but not all countries. The irony of it is that in all the commentaries that I've heard concerning our support of the attack against Omar Gaddafi in Libya, we have stated that his was unique and that therefore we had to stop him from annihilating his own people and that we had to make sure that he no longer had the capacity to do that. At the same time, more deaths have occurred in Syria, but we have not caused any military intervention. More suppression of rights, human rights, in Saudi Arabia. You have no rights if you're a woman in Saudi Arabia, and you have no freedoms in Saudi Arabia. And look at in Yemen and the other countries that we have supported, and look at in Egypt. And should we not consider this, that for the past 40 years, we have supported virtually every major dictatorship or military regime or oligarch or king that has ruled their people, suppressing freedoms, unions, rights of all types, no democracy whatsoever. Most of their people live in abject poverty. We have supported the military, industrial, and security complexes. Without our support, Saudi Arabia long ago would have been overthrown by their own public. So we've done absolutely the opposite of what we purport to do. And even when we late recognized, that there was legitimacy in the demonstrations throughout the Middle East, you did not hear the President of the United States or any former President of the United States go before the American public and say, we should apologize for our secret, overt and covert military interventions. Our Congress should apologize for giving massive military aid, but never any money to build better homes, schools, hospitals, to help them with farming and greenhouses and sustainable agriculture. All the money we knew went to the most corrupt and powerful in your country to keep you powerless. If we had anyone in the United States in a position of power who had been responsible for those crimes against humanity to have confessed that, I believe it would have gone a long way in improving the perception in the world, especially in the Middle East, that yes, we did wrong. We were on the wrong side of history. We were on the wrong side of truth and justice and freedom and democracy. But at least we acknowledge it now, something we've never done in our history. And to this day, not a single person has done that apologizing. Now I want to show you one of the most egregious and a little personal story on this. I had a friend who was a flight attendant on long international flights. And one day this friend called me and said, you won't believe what happened. I said, what happened? And the flight attendant said that her friend, who was on this flight with her, went over in the middle of the flight to offer, they were going to Saudi Arabia, to offer dinner. And she looked at the woman, and she asked the woman, what did she want to drink or eat? With that, the man beside her husband got up and beat the flight attendant. I mean, really hurt her, slugged her in the mouth, slugged her in the head, and kept smacking her, hitting her head on the floor. When the plane landed in Saudi Arabia, the flight attendant was arrested and detained, not the man. And it was pointed out to this flight attendant that in that culture, you do not ever address a woman who has a man present first. So then that flight attendant was reprimanded as if she had done something wrong. All she asked was, "What would you like to drink and eat?" And that's how it went down. But that's how it goes down all the time. So let's look at the tyrants of Saudi Arabia. The United States has maintained strong political and economic relations with Saudi Arabia despite the country's abominable and undemocratic record in political freedom and human rights. Now, to better understand the philosophy behind the Saudi government, you have to look at the year 1932, when Sheikh Ibn Saud became the nation's leader and instituted Wahhabism, a very strict branch of Islam. And through present day, Saudi Arabia's policies have been shaped by the ultra-Orthodox teachings found on Wahhabism that call for political and social life to be dominated by religious doctrine under the mandates of Sharia law. The laws in Saudi Arabia are sexist, discriminatory against women. They require segregation of the sexes, and it's forbidden for women to drive. Women may not engage in numerous activities without the consent of a male guardian under a set of rules known as mahram. Now, such activities include traveling outside of the home, receiving medical attention, attending school, and filing for divorce. Women are required to sit in the back of public buses. Girls cannot engage in sports during recreational time at school. And in cases of sexual abuse, it is exceedingly difficult for women to pursue any legal recourse since they must produce four witnesses. In addition, the testimony of a woman is considered half that of a man's testimony. Oftentimes, sexual abuse of females will come at the hands of male relatives, and in cases of pregnancy, harsh penalties are usually given to women while the perpetrator goes unpunished. In 2006, a horrific case involving a group of men gang-rape a 19-year-old girl. The men went on trial, seven of them. The victim, the woman, was sentenced to 90 lashes for being in a car alone with a man just before the rape was committed. Now, as a percentage, Saudi women are less represented in the political, economic, and scientific arenas than women in any other country in the Islamic world. Repressive practices in Saudi Arabia go far beyond what is codified into law. As it is currently structured, the Saudi political system severely limits the basic freedoms of its citizens, especially those considered to be in any form of dissent. Consequently, thousands of Saudis have been subjected to incarceration, torture, solitary confinement without any legal recourse, and murder. Saad al-Hashimi, a physician and human rights activist, went public in 2011 with allegations that he, along with six other men, were illegally detained by the Saudi Minister of Interior starting in February 2007. After distributing materials calling for political change and the formation of human rights groups, he claims he was thrown in prison where he was to endure vicious treatment by authorities. The alleged transgressions included being forced to stay in a very cold room without clothing, naked, for 4 days until he signed documents that waived his rights to legal counsel. Upon explaining to the judge what had transpired, no action was taken. He also says that he was given electric shocks and forced into solitary confinement. In a case from April 2000, a Saudi court condemned nine transvestites to over 5 years imprisonment and over 2,000 lashes each. Normally, a human body could not withstand more than 150 before the person would literally die. You would have no skin on your body, and you'd bleed to death. More recently, in 2010, a man was sentenced to 5 years in jail and 500 lashes because he acknowledged being a homosexual. He was not caught engaging in homosexuality, just that he was homosexual. Now, put it in perspective. It is virtually unimaginable anyone could survive 500 lashes. So the United States government was fully aware that this man would be beaten to death in a rather barbaric manner for simply being homosexual. That is how it works. But the United States also in 2010 received the largest contract in the history of America for weapons from Saudi Arabia. It was about $60 billion. Capital punishment is widely used in Saudi Arabia. For example, just this past year, three security guards were beheaded in the city of Arar after being convicted of drug trafficking hashish and using government-owned vehicles in an attempt to deter crime. And Saudi police often calls for public crucifixion after beheadings. So first you're beheaded, then you're crucified. And a suspicious and concerning trend, a disproportionate number of them are foreign-born migrants, many of which remain unaware that they're to be killed until their last day. Children are often treated as harshly as adults in the penal system. Children as young as 13 have been sentenced to death, and there are other cases where minors were placed in solitary confinement. Also notable is this systemic bias against minorities that exists in Saudi Arabia. A United States State Department report detailed how the Saudi government has targeted practitioners of minority religions like Christianity, Judaism, and Shia Islam through economic and political discrimination. The leaders of the United States have proven that they are capable of overlooking all of these egregious cases of injustice and pursue a close economic relationship with the world's largest producer of petroleum. Saudi Arabia currently exports more than 1 million barrels of oil a day to the U.S. Despite criticism of Saudi Arabia's oppressive policies coming from many in the United States, the Saudi government has been a close ally of America since the 1980s. Their alliance was formed during the volatile period of time in the Middle East. The Soviet Union was expanding influence in places like Afghanistan, and relations between the United States and Iran quickly deteriorated after the Shah was replaced by the staunchly anti-American Ayatollah Khomeini. In an attempt to shore up support during the Cold War, Ronald Reagan's administration reached out to Saudi Arabia, providing military protection of their vast oil fields. The Saudis were suspicious of Soviet designs in the Middle East and elsewhere, and the United States received tens of billions of dollars from the Saudis to help stem the Soviet threat in countries like Afghanistan, Nicaragua, Ethiopia. Presently, the United States considers Saudi Arabia a vital partner in the war against terror and promoting stability in the Middle East. Amongst the current unrest associated with the Arab Spring, Saudis have turned to social media networks like Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook to circulate petitions calling for the government reforms and to help organize demonstrations. In an apparent move to quell the undercurrent of insurrection, King Abdullah pledged $36 billion for social welfare reforms, a move that caused citizens to flood government buildings applying for state-funded aid. The Saudi government has also stepped up its rhetoric against predominantly a Shiite country of Iran, accusing their Persian counterparts of inciting uprisings that have defined the Arab Spring. Even though the Wahhabi sect of Islam is opposed to the doctrines of Shiism, many speculate that such declarations against one of America's greatest enemies serve another purpose, that the United States continues to remain quiet on the issue of Saudi human rights violations. And then we have Egypt. Since the signing of the Camp David Accords in 1979, the United States has provided huge sums of military aid to the Egyptian government. Much of it has been used to oppress the Egyptian people. Since 1979, Egypt has been the recipient of well over $50 billion in aid from the United States, almost all of it going to the Egyptian military. And just last year alone, we gave $1.3 billion in aid that was earmarked for Egyptian troops, $250 million in economic assistance. But that generally goes to major corporations and wealthy families. Egypt trails only Israel in United States aid, and this reality was brought to focus during the 2011 uprisings that ousted leader Mubarak, who had been in office since 1981. Virtually all the tear gas canisters, all the tanks, and all the warplanes used to try to quell protesters, you guessed it, were produced by American companies. Corporations like Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Boeing, and General Electric have gained tremendously from the United States appropriations of military aid to Egypt. Over the last 10 years, Lockheed Martin netted nearly $4 billion in contracts directly associated with arming Egypt. During his presidency, Mubarak proved himself a loyal ally of the United States. Echoing the views of American policymakers on issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in January 2011, during the peaceful demonstration in Cairo's main Tahrir Square, officials in the Obama administration then asked whether Egypt's leader should step down, and President Obama and Vice President Biden and Secretary of State Clinton all expressed how vital Mubarak had been to U.S. interest. And his White House spokesman, Robert Gibbs, put it, quote, "This isn't a choice between the government and the people of Egypt. This is not about taking sides," unquote. In one interview, Vice President Biden stated that he would not label Mubarak as a dictator, going on to say that what was transpiring was simply Egypt's citizens searching for, quote, "a little more access and a little more opportunity." Really? Well, that Mubarak is on trial now. And evidently, the President of the United States, the Vice President, Secretary of Clinton, came down on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of truth once again. The United States Department of State and other groups have provided ample documentation of Egypt's deplorable human rights record. In 2005, presidential election won by Mubarak marked the beginning of his fifth consecutive six-year term. The election was characterized by accusations of voter fraud and illegal activities on the part of Mubarak's National Democratic Party so as to defeat opposition candidates. Over the past four decades, Egypt's government has been notorious for denying its citizens of their right to form political parties, labor unions, and other organizations that might challenge the existing bureaucratic structure. After the 1981 assassination of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, a state of emergency was declared and was never lifted during the Mubarak decades in power. This opened the door for the government to move ahead with oppressive policies and exert undue military force against its own people. Within this framework, many civilians accused of nonviolent crimes have been tried before military tribunals where they've been deprived of all rights of due process. The issue of torture looms large in Egypt. Under Mubarak, officials routinely detained individuals and subjected them to brutal torture that sometimes resulted in death. Political activists and those suspected of engaging in homosexual activity were frequently victims of torture, and in very few cases were these crimes ever investigated by the Egyptian government. Also common in Egypt is the apprehension of children on the street by police officers who suspect they may be prone to delinquency. According to information gathered by Human Rights Watch, these children are usually beaten with batons and fists and sexually abused at the hands of local authorities. Other forms of torture carried out, including electrical shocks and flogging with electric cables, leather straps, and sticks. These beatings sometimes occur while the victim is suspended in awkward, painful positions. The domestic human rights group, Human Rights Center for the Assistance of Prisoners, reported that a 26-year-old engineer was killed after the government apparatus known as state security investigations tortured him to death in an effort to draw a confession out of him about his political affiliation, which political party did he belong to. The SSI provided no autopsy on the death and told the man's family that he had committed suicide. In the same year, another person, Mohammad Agab Mohammed, was reportedly taken in police custody while in a cafe. He was held without charges and died later that day. Family members remarked that his corpse was covered with bruises and was bleeding from the mouth. A man taken in by the SSI in 2007 described to Human Rights Watch the conversation between the security officials and the detainees they were about to torture. He said the SSI authorities maliciously told him that it would hurt so much they would be screaming. Same report detailed the experiences of a law student who was subject to several rounds of torture. Quote, he stayed a long time upstairs, up to 4 hours at a time. He was tortured by electricity, as well as beatings. He didn't even have to tell us, though. You could tell by his condition. We saw the burn marks from the electrocution. He was nearly comatose when they carried him into his cell. His face was extremely swollen and bruised. He was shaking. There were burn marks on his hand and elbows and the feet and toes, unquote. Members of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, an organization that works to protect and promote religious and civil freedoms, was hindered by government bureaucrats from applying for recognition as an NGO. The organization's petition for recognition was rejected more than six times. Each time they were required to resubmit paperwork and work with largely unresponsive government agencies. There have also been widespread reports of NGOs in Egypt having great trouble securing subsidies from international sponsors because the Egyptian Ministry of Insurance and Social Affairs, the body charged with overseeing such donations, regularly hampers the flow of international assistance to humanitarian groups. And in April of this year, 91 peaceful protesters were arrested after publicly demonstrating against the emergency powers exercised by Mubarak's government. The group was corralled by local authorities in Cairo, and numerous witnesses report beatings and sexual assaults of female protesters. What has gone largely unnoticed in the Western media is how Egypt's dictatorial practices contributed to the radicalization of Ayman al-Zawahiri, who served as one of Osama bin Laden's closest advisors. As an Egyptian citizen, he felt the full force of the nation's restrictive policies that sought to destroy the Muslim Brotherhood, a group he belonged to. Many experts point to Egypt's recent history of political and social repression as a catalyst for some of these individuals' shift to radical Islam. Now, why is this important? Because as we speak today, even though Mubarak and some of his top henchmen have been put in jail and are now going to be tried, the power that we're dealing with every day that still controls Egypt is the military. How did they learn how to torture? We taught them. Where did we teach them? The School of the Americas. That will be on my next report. I'm going to give you the details, very comprehensive details, of how we specialized in working with all of our partners. We showed them how to tap the phones. We gave them the equipment that they could drive a van down the street and put this particular apparatus pointed toward an apartment, and suddenly they would have the full visualization of who was in the apartment, what was being done, and what was being said. By the way, this is currently used in the United States. We showed them how to infiltrate all human rights group. If there was any peace group, if there was any union, if there was any women's group, infiltrate it, find the leaders, and then how to arrest them. Take them to sites so that they could be tortured or killed or disappeared, which means killed, so we no longer had to worry about any form of democracy or freedom movement in their country. Now, why was that important? Because almost without exception, every single country that we support in its military, in its security services, in its black operations, in its kidnappings, torture, and murder are associated with protecting American interest. American contracts, or Americans doing businesses in a particular country. And we also want to make sure that those American corporations, if they're working in a country, can exploit the labor market. For example, if you are doing business and you have the right to form a union, you have the right to work and get paid a good wage, and then if you work overtime, be paid overtime, you won't make as much profit for the corporation. So, no unions, no fair living wage, no environmental protection, no workman's compensation if you're injured on the job. And if you're an agitator, if you speak out, you can be identified, you can be kidnapped or arrested, you can be beaten, threatened, or killed with impunity. Now, when you look at the larger picture and you pull back, you will see that the United States has supported at least 80 governments that regularly engage in suppression of their rights and gross human rights abuses, and we're there to protect their right to do that because it protects America's financial interest. I'll go through a few more to complete our discussion today. Let's take a look at Vietnam. By the 1950s, the United States government began to view Vietnam and its leader, Ho Chi Minh, as a potential threat to democracy. He had not done anything to deserve this. This was a surprising development when put into perspective. Vietnam had sided with America during World War II, and even requested assistance from the Truman administration when fighting for independence from the French. Ho Chi Minh borrowed much of his Vietnamese Declaration of Independence from the French and the American version. Washington, however, was determined to label Ho Chi Minh as a communist threat. Beginning in 1954, the U.S. infiltrated Vietnam with covert operatives charged with the task of toppling the government. The 1960s saw an escalation of the U.S. military involvement in Vietnam and the start of the Phoenix Program, a campaign designed to eliminate members of the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. The Phoenix Program was carried out by secret operatives working for the United States intelligence agencies, mainly the CIA. When it concluded its operations, it had claimed the lives of 20,000 civilians. Many of them were tortured to death by local authorities, who were coached on how to kill them, how to torture them by the CIA. In 1975, American forces left Vietnam, and Saigon was quickly taken over by the North Vietnamese and renamed Ho Chi Minh City. The United States objectives in the country had failed, and at a very high cost. More than 1 million soldiers siding with the North had been killed by the United States and its allies. 58,000 U.S. troops were killed and over 350,000 Americans injured. And the estimates of civilian deaths are about 3 million people died. The Vietnamese government hoped to cooperate with America but was rejected by the war hawks in the U.S. government, including, I might mention, the person who was selected by the Kennedys, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, who helped convince both John and Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson to deploy troops to Vietnam. McNamara was highly instrumental in creating a military stalemate that devastated a small nation and cost the U.S. hundreds of billions of dollars. And let us not forget, those of us who know real history, time and again, McNamara and General Westmoreland, overseeing the military adventure there, said if we had more troops and more bombs and more soldiers, and at different times more was provided. And then we realized that we could not win. Today, when you listen to the neocons, you'll frequently hear them say, this time we have to do the whole job, not pull out like we did in Vietnam. Yeah, and if we'd have stayed another 5 or 10 years in Vietnam, we still would not have won. Let's look at Cambodia. After its independence from the French crown in 1953, Cambodia became an important part of the U.S. designs on Southeast Asian politics. During the 1950s and 60s, the Cambodian government was highly suspicious of U.S. activities in the region. Cambodian leader Prince Sihanouk was worried that U.S. policies included the support of depraved warlords and the creation of an Air America Airlines, which turned out to be the front for a CIA-sponsored drug trafficking operation through the Golden Triangle. Tension between the U.S. and Cambodia increased even more when the U.S. military activities in South Vietnam spilled into Cambodia in 1969. The U.S. dropped cluster bombs and carpet bombs, napalm bombs, every form of payload containing phosphorus and napalm. Despite being in violation of the Geneva Convention, U.S. military incursions continued until 1977 and left 500,000 civilian people in Cambodia dead. A staggering 2,757,941 tons of bombs were dropped in Cambodia during this period. Now let me give you perspective. During all of World War II, the total amount of bombs dropped by the Allies was slightly over 2 million tons. This figure includes bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we dropped more bombs in Cambodia in our secret war than all of World War II bombs. In 1970, the Prince Sihanouk was overthrown in a coup ordered by Richard Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. He was replaced by Lon Nol, a military leader sympathetic to American interest. The U.S. provided support for Lon Nol's regime, but he quickly became unpopular and was challenged by a guerrilla group in a political party known as the Khmer Rouge. Later on, Henry Kissinger was caught lying to the American public about Cambodia when he denied any U.S. involvement in the country. This came after thousands of operations had already been run by the U.S. military. The Khmer Rouge eventually ascended to power in 1975 and installed Pol Pot as their leader. Now, Pol Pot was a ruthless despot who was directly responsible for the murder of about 2.5 million civilians. Cambodian people, were decimated. That's over a quarter of the entire country's population. Pol Pot presided over one of the most vicious cases of genocide in history. He targeted educated civilians, all progressives, rounded them up in the outlying areas where they were able then to be starved to death in camps. The United States covertly supported the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot until he fled to Thailand in 1979. The U.S. support of the murderous Khmer Rouge continued because of the party's opposition to the Communist Party and powers in Vietnam and to the communist Heng Samrin, who ruled Cambodia as chairman of the People's Republic of Kampuchea from 1979-1983. So quite simply, we can say this, and we can say this unequivocally. The United States government supported genocide against 2.5 million innocent civilians in Cambodia. We have never apologized for that genocide. 2.5 million innocent individuals, and Henry Kissinger is alive today and is on corporate boards, invited to Obama's White House. And should this man not be asked to give evidence and have those who have evidence against him, and yet it's not been done. In an article written by Scott Lowry in Covert Action Quarterly, he revealed that the Reagan administration provided the Khmer Rouge with $86 million over a six-year span. In effect, the U.S. government was using tax dollars to fund a group that had exterminated millions of people. Remind Sean Hannity of that the next time you hear him talking about how great Reagan was. It's in the detail, Sean. It's in real history, not in the myths that you all live by. In the 1980s, the United States also helped equip militants under the command of Norodom Sihanouk, father of the Prince Sihanouk, who was deposed in 1970. The U.S. poured money into both of these groups simply because they sought to undermine the authority of the communist government power. But let's also not forget Laos. The recent history of Laos is a testament to the destructive nature of United States interventionist policies. After declaring its independence from France in 1954, Laos was looked upon by American officials as a potential breeding ground for communist government. In order to prevent the spread of communism, the United States dispatched CIA agents to the country where they carried out activities with the intention of wiping out the Laotian Communist Party, known as the Pathet Lao. Despite 16 years of pervasive action by the CIA, the Pathet Lao became the ruling party in 1975. And after North Vietnamese troops entered Laos in the early 1960s, U.S. military turned its attention to the small, mostly agricultural nation. American warplanes began a nine-year bombing campaign that would claim the lives of at least 300,000 of these civilians. The organization Legacies of War compiled several sobering statistics that offer a wealth of insight into the bombing of Laos. The United States dropped 260 million cluster bombs in Laos, from 1964 to 73. On average, the U.S. dropped a plane load of bombs every 8 minutes for 9 years straight. A remarkable 30% of the bombs dropped never detonated. Each year, over 100 fatalities are reported in connection with unexploded bomb material. At least 20,000 people have died this way. 40% of them were children. Adjusted for inflation, the United States spent much more money waging war in Laos over 3 days than it has spent on cleanup efforts in the country over the last 16 years. Over the past 40 years, over 500,000 of the estimated 75 million cluster munitions that failed to detonate have been cleared. Only 500,000. Because of this rampant devastation, Laos stands out as the most bombed country on Earth. And then for Angola, the United States' first incursion in Angola came in 1860 when American forces were sent there, according to the U.S. State Department, to act as peacekeepers and protect American lives. In reality, they were being used to protect property in the city of Kisumbu from unruly natives. Upon its independence from Portugal in 1975, the vacuum of power was filled by leftists of the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola. In an attempt to ascend its power in Africa, and also the spread of communism, the United States chose to throw its support behind the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola party and its leader. And through the CIA, the American government supplied military and logistical support to that group as they worked to bring down the Popular Movement Party. The testimony of the CIA Station Chief Operations Angola, John Stockwell, explains how the CIA also trained and equipped the South African Army to assist the troops in combat. This means the United States was giving arms and assistance to the same forces that helped uphold the South African apartheid. And Stockwell also mentioned that the United States formed four little mercenary armies and delivered them into Angola to do their dirty work business for the CIA. The U.S. employed a strategy in Angola that was aimed at destabilizing the leftist government so that the Soviet Union felt obligated to pour money and resources into a complex situation that was next to unwinnable. When questioned about the conflict of Angola, Henry Kissinger claimed that Washington knew nothing of the civil unrest there and the United States had come to the aid of this group only after the Soviets arrived. Documentation from the National Security Archive contradicts Kissinger's denial. U.S. involvement and proves the U.S. operatives were active in Angola before the Soviet Union showed up. Despite legislation passed by Congress that banned funding for the Angola War in 1976, the CIA continued to engage in illegal, unethical, immoral, clandestine missions to arm and support the junta members. The history of unwavering U.S. support for them is even more disturbing given revelations about the many crimes committed by them and the military groups regularly engaged in rape and murder of innocent civilians, of which the CIA was fully aware. It was a common practice of enslaving women and forcing them to perform sexual acts for members of the army. A ceasefire in 1991 dampened hostilities, but just 1 year later, the group became indignant over an election that was fairly lost. Still enjoyable, consider financial support from American politicians like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who orchestrated a series of attacks on Angolans throughout the nation in a vicious and bloody ordeal that would be called the War of the Cities. The aggression killed 50,000 people over the course of 1 year. And so it goes. And let us not at all forget, finally today, the Rwandan genocide. In 1994, President Bill Clinton chose not to intervene in Rwanda for a full-scale ethnic cleansing of Tutsi tribe members at the hands of the Hutu tribe, which claimed the lives of an estimated 800,000 people over the course of 90 days. Ample evidence exists that Clinton and U.S. government were briefed regularly on the situation, but chose not to act. Part 2 will be conducted next week at this time. I thank you very much for listening. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live from New York City. Now to our next program.